Okay, so we're going to talk about lessons from wisdom, marriage, and family. So first of all, I was going the wrong way. Okay.
Yeah. There you go. Well, we are Ron and Lori Clark. We are from Portland, Oregon, and we've lived there 19 years this year. We're from Missouri originally.
Mm.
We have... Oh, come on in.
Come on in.
You get to sit in the front.
Unlike Gallagher, we do not hand out waterproof bibs.
Oh, it's closed. It's closed, Miss Graham. You need to leave. Well, like I say, we're Ron and Lori Clark from Portland, Oregon. We've been there 19 years. We have... three sons and a daughter-in-law. Our oldest son and his wife have been married 4 years. And then we have a 14-year-old and a 12-year-old. So we have a big age range. So we are older parents now with younger kids. So that's been fun. We entered ministry. Ron was a youth minister when I met him. And so I kind of just went into ministry. We've been doing that. Ron's been doing it for 31 years.
Yeah.
31 years, but we've been married 30 years this December. So.
We were in youth ministry, and then we went into ministry in rural Missouri, and realized very quickly, I was a biology and chemistry major. I'd gotten converted in veterinary school and flunked out, which was a good thing, I think. I believe it was a good thing. When we started doing ministry in rural Missouri, after about 3 years in a small church, we figured we needed more training. So went on to Harding Graduate School, got my Master's of Divinity. We moved back to the same town, ended up with an eight-year time there, and then came out to Portland, Oregon. Finished my doctorate at Harding, and then we started preaching at a larger congregation. And after about 8 years, we figured, you know, it was time to go on. We had been doing a lot of domestic violence work in the community, partnering with a lot of agencies. I taught at George Fox Evangelical Seminary. It's now Portland Seminary. And we kind of felt like we may end up having to go back to the South, you know, at a larger congregation. We talked with churches, and I sat down and had coffee with Stan Granberg, Gina's husband, Dr. Granberg, and he said, you need to plant a church. And we're building a church planting movement with Kairos Church Planting. And I remember thinking, well, Lori won't go for that. And he said, well, why don't you ask her? And I came home and she said, I think it's a great idea. And so we planted a church in downtown Portland. So we're in our 10th year. We found out a couple years ago from some church planters downtown Portland that it's a 90% failure rate. So we actually, 10 years, we feel pretty good to be. And the group that, come on in, have a seat. Front row is wide open. we don't spit when we talk, so you're good. But we found out
wrong about that.
Thank you.
We found out from the church that was in the school before us. I talked with the guy like last year, and he was like, "Oh, we didn't make it another year." So I'm glad you guys are still there. So we're celebrating 10 years. But in that time, we continued to partner with. Abuse and trafficking and prostitution, anti-prostitution, law enforcement, houseless groups. So we work in the community, and as a congregation, a lot of our people are involved in a lot of the community groups. So we've helped to plant, to help start a couple congregations. One's going, one didn't make it, and we've had others go into ministry. We've mentored. So we're approaching this from the perspective of ministry, trying to balance all of that. We finished a book last year called The Reflections on from the Marriage Table, and we have some flyers here. I don't know if they have it in the bookstore, but so some of this is going to be taken from that. But we wanted to talk today about what does the wisdom literature say about marriage and family? What are some things that are there? So I think in the next slide. Yes, I'm going to.
So what verses from Ecclesiastes, Proverbs, or Job speak to you about marriage and family?
Yeah, when you think about those, and what are some things in there that talk about family that you can think of?
train up a child in one year.
We were just
talking about that. Yeah. How has that been interpreted? Train up a child in one year.
Beat the daylights out of them and they might make it. When they're really, really old.
Okay.
Ecclesiastes says two is better than one.
Yeah. Yep. Teamwork, I guess. Okay.
I was thinking enjoy the, this is more Song of Solomon, does it kind of count?
Yeah.
Maybe not. Enjoy the wife.
Should have put that Song of Solomon. We had a great lesson last night from Rick Mars on that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I should have put Song of Solomon in there. Yeah. What else do you think of?
I didn't think that Job's wife was very supportive when he was suffering.
But it speaks to you about it.
Yeah. Job's wife wasn't supportive.
Yeah, we know that happens.
Yeah. Curse God and die.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else?
All the there is a season versus in Ecclesiastes. Yeah. Apply to marriage and family.
Okay. Yeah, Gary Chapman has a great book, The Four Seasons of Marriage. Kind of along that line, marriage goes through cycles or seasons or stages. Okay.
And then the virtuous wife, a woman in Proverbs 31, who can find, and that's so about the ideal wife and mother.
I like the cord of three strands. You know, you got husband, wife, and God tied together. Then you want to unravel.
Okay. Yeah. So it's interesting because sometimes when we ask groups, we'll get, it's better to share a meal in a corner of a house than be with a nagging wife or a dripping roof with like a nagging wife or an angry man, heated man. You know, I'll hear that sometimes. That there's some negative ones that to train up a child, you know, that's understood negatively by some. Okay. So what we thought we'd do is we'd talk a little bit about... all right. There we go.
That one's yours.
That's mine. Okay. So the interesting points about wisdom. We're going to look at three parts. The first one... The book of Proverbs is the only wisdom writing in the ancient Near East where a female, Song of Solomon, the female talked a lot, but a female takes on the role of a goddess and has authority to speak. And of course, in Proverbs, Lady Wisdom is seen as this goddess, and she's speaking to students. And so it's the only book in the ancient Near East where females are giving this wisdom to males, to young males. We'll look at Proverbs 13:10 about listening. You know, a wise person listens to advice. And then Ecclesiastes 9, I think Gina said it, enjoy the wife of your youth.
Where there is strife, there is pride. But wisdom is found in those who take advice. Whoever disregards discipline comes to poverty and shame, but whoever heeds correction is honored. Walk with the wise and become wise, for a companion of fools suffers harm.
What are some of the thoughts here with about marriage when it comes to listening to advice? How does that come into marriage? You know, for instance, with us, we've learned in dysfunctional domestic violence relationships, it's a one-way street. Typically, Lori's works with the survivors. I've been trained to work with batterers. So what we hear is that the men come in saying that they're oppressed and she doesn't listen to me. But what's actually happening is they're squashing their wife's voice. Because we say things like, well, what does your wife think? Well, I don't know. Or, I want to listen to the wife, the voice, my wife's voice. So what one thing that we see is that in a relationship, when people aren't listening to each other, they don't value each other, then there becomes strife and tension. It becomes unhealthy.
Right. Yeah, that's what we've noticed. And I appreciated Rick's talk last night because he used the term healthy families. And we've, for so many years, talked about abuse in the church, and it does. It turns people off because, well, there's no abuse. And it's such a caustic word that now we talk about being healthy and having healthy families. And I thought that he was spot on. He said, sometimes we don't want to talk about that because it's so much easier to talk about the bad that's going on instead of what we should be. So we've changed a lot over the years, and we use the term healthy, and we talk about healthy families and healthy marriages.
Yeah, so if we were, when we used to come back in the older days at Pepperdine and do a class on domestic violence, we have two or three. So we just changed it to healthy. And look at this. Last year we were full. So we find that people want to talk about healthy relationships.
Yes.
But a key in a healthy relationship is to listen, to treat your other person as if they have wisdom. You think, for instance, when I talk with a lot of guys and say, what does your wife think? What does your spouse think? What does your girlfriend think? Your partner? A lot of them struggle because where we were raised in a society where men do not value the opinion of women. So for my wife to say, I don't like that, or that bothers me, or that offends me, a lot of guys are taught, well, just tell them to get over it. You know, you need to have thicker skin. Okay. Prime example, you know, so look in the Bill Cosby sexual assault allegations. You know, in the very beginning, we didn't believe him. People didn't typically believe, oh, it's women. You know, they're out to get him. But after more and more came forward, and now he's finally admitted it, look what's happened. We dropped it. You know, we're not listening anymore because we continue to have high-profile sexual assault allegations, and people don't listen because we're assuming that women's voices or vulnerable people's voices don't carry any credibility. So, and as guys growing up in a society, one of the things we want to teach, especially men, is that your spouse, if they're the most important person in your life, they're their best friend, and they have the best wisdom, I think. But the same thing's true with females and males, I know.
Right.
And that's why when Proverbs has the Lady Wisdom giving this wisdom to these young men, and they're listening to her, we're realizing that the Jewish community believed that men can learn powerful lessons from women, you know. And that's an important thing, especially having boys. We've had to teach them.
Yeah.
So the next one.
Go eat your food with gladness and drink your wine with a joyful heart, for God has already approved what you do. Always be clothed in white and always anoint your head with oil. Enjoy life with your wife, whom you love, all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun, all your meaningless days, for this is your lot in life and in your toilsome labor under the sun. I run into so many young couples who they don't spend time with their spouse. And that's just, it really breaks our heart, or they don't have time or they don't make time. And even now, after 30 years, we make time to be together at least every week. We visit every morning. We get up early just to connect and to have that time together. We do a lot. I don't think we do, but people will tell us, how do you do all that you do? And it's kind of, that's just how we've made it. So we always spend time together. We do a lot of stuff together, but I have a separate job. I teach preschool every day. And so, but we do a lot of the things in the community together where we spend time together. We work on it together. In our book, it's called The Marriage Table. And someone said, I like that visual because we started out as just the two of us, and we've added chairs along the way. We've added family, friends, you know, people that come in. We have at Thanksgiving, we have a lot of people at Agape who don't have family. So that's the one holiday that we open up to everybody. But Christmas, our boys have said, can it just be us? And we're like, yep, it can. So we've learned to set boundaries as, and to have healthy boundaries as a marriage couple. And I think that's funny, not funny, but I like that because you need to enjoy each other's time together and find that.
Yeah, what are some of the reasons that you think today people may struggle with enjoying their marriages, their relationship, their family? Terrence Real is a therapist who has written a book, How Can I Get Through to You, about men and anger and aggression. But as a therapist, he said he believes, from his research, 1 in 3, and he estimates even 2 in 3 marriages are not happy. And we think about it in the church, we've always said, well, they've been married a long time, that means it's healthy. But as we start talking about, we'll talk about love and trust in a moment, but happiness and fulfillment, we're beginning to see that that's not there. And we've shared that at faith-based groups, and we've had people, older couples, argue with us, but we've had younger Christian people there say, wait a minute, I grew up in a Christian home, and here's what I saw. And it was very negative. And so why is it that today we're seeing so many couples struggling to enjoy that family, that marriage, that relationship? What are your thoughts? Yes?
I think a lot of them let the pressures of the outside world cloud them. They get involved with things that, say, finances or job, and then they bring that stress home. And maybe they're both stressed, and they come together and they clash.
Okay.
And if they're not focused on the Lord and their walk with each other and with the Lord, that can divide them, put a wedge in.
Yeah, so outside pressures like finances and that, which we're seeing is very common. The push to raise minimum wage, as a people who work with houselessness, we're very much in tune to a lot of the issues with the poor. But, the push for minimum wage increases and things like that, they will have an effect on families, because there are a lot of families working two jobs. And they're working hard, and then they're bringing it home, and they're stressed over finances, So that's one outside issue. Yeah.
I was going to say there's a lot more distractions now that I probably don't before. Mm-hmm. Because, everyone has a cell phone, with basically a computer now, so you can distract yourself on that for multiple hours in bed next to your spouse. And you have that time together, but you're not actually connecting.
I called out my 14-year-old the other day. I was like, you always have your nose in that phone. And he pulled up this research thing about how parents who are always getting on their kids are the ones sitting there with their face in their phone. And I was sitting there kind of looking at my phone. He's like, see, Mom, you do it too. I'm like, you're right, so let's put it up. No, you don't have to. I said, yeah, we do. But that's true. And I also think, and I love Facebook. I am the biggest Facebook junkie. But I have a coworker who... she compares so much of her life to everybody on there. And she'll even say, I know that's probably not how it is, but it still bothers me that they post that. And I have to, and she just feels that pressure because her kids may not be doing that. And I said, people only post the best on there most of the time. Some people don't. But I think that's true. I think we do. I notice that even with us now.
Yeah, I remember that conversation with you and Hunter, because I texted Hunter, don't be disrespectful to your mom.
So you're all three on
your phone. Yeah.
Yes.
Let's say not addressing the flags in the relationship early on. And as their relationship evolved, it tends to come up again. And somehow they'll get to a point where they never really got to know each other early in their relationship, and these problems become, a gap in their thinking of each other, expectations, or unrealistic expectations of each other.
Yeah, it's like the two walk together in the three-chord strand. We talk a lot in the book about teamwork, and the couple is a team. And just like any team, as you move along, you have to evolve and develop and adapt. And what we find is that sometimes couples, that they meet and they're together, but they don't realize that we're going to grow and we're going to evolve. If I change jobs, this is going to change. And when we have kids, this is going to change. And there's that period where kids are little and we're exhausted, and people are talking about intimacy, and we're like, man, we can barely keep our eyes open, and we put them to bed and we go to sleep. But we call that a gutting out phase. Or grind it out. You just keep working on it. But people don't sometimes see that we have to evolve. And then in the evolving, red flags come up. If I grew up in a traditional home where Mom did all the cooking and we're both working, why didn't you fix dinner? Because I'm working, I'm tired. And so we have to, how do we adapt to that? Having those conversations are important.
I think just like what you were saying, when early days, when someone may have cooked and the other one didn't, it also goes back to the role model of a person being married, or maybe they're, the person's background was different than the other person's background as far as what is the ideal role model of marriage or ideal role model of family, you know. So that's different when you get together, you know, because maybe one didn't have that and the other one did have it, so.
Our daughter-in-law, her and our son have dated since they were 14, and they're 25 now, and they've been married 4 years. And it's funny because she grew up in a home like that. It was not traditional. There was, I don't, ever marriage. So coming into our family looked a lot different. But it's funny because our son, and I didn't really realize, but now I'm intentionally doing it, he does the cleaning and the cooking because that's just a natural comforting role for him. They both work full-time. But he said, that works for me. And so it's interesting, but her and I have had that conversation. She goes, but I never saw traditional roles. And I was like, good for you. And I'm glad that he feels comfortable doing that. And, yeah, so, yeah, that's true, too. His dad's a big helper in the house. He learned it through that.
But even traditional roles there, you know, well, it's my job to mow, you know, and you don't you can't mow. And but, you know, you grow up with these traditional roles, and it's hard to say, wait a minute, it's a different time. So we have to find ways to adapt.
Or what works for you. That's what we always tell people. But going back to identifying red flags, we've had a few young or any age couple, actually, that are getting married, and we always push, do some premarital counseling. It doesn't solve everything. It doesn't might not even identify. But so many lately have chosen not to. Oh, we'll do it later down the road. We'll do it later. We don't have time to do it right now. And I think you can talk about so many things beforehand that you might not even realize are going to come up. But I think that we're not seeing that as much sometimes.
Yeah, and some red flags that we see. Pornography. We always, male and female now. But if you've ever looked at, if you have a habit, if that's become important, if that's become a part of your life, you have to have that discussion in premarital counseling before you're married because it will come back. Sexual abuse, if that's happened as a child, a lot of times people don't want to share that with their. But the partner, the spouse, has to be involved in that healing. Sexual abuse. And then, you know, going over the dysfunctional functional or dysfunctional issues in a family, helping them to identify what was healthy and what was unhealthy in my family in premarital counseling and as an intermarriage, they can see those things because they come up in times of stress and people tend to revert to that. Yeah. Somebody else said.
Just real quick, the state of Texas recently doubled the fee for marriage license. And if you do premarital counseling, it's free. So you have to have 8 hours of licensed, not licensed, but certified premarital counseling, and then they waive all of the fees because they have found that marriages that go through premarital counseling have a 70-80% chance of success rate.
That's
so
awesome.
You know, and I'm involved in that.
That's awesome.
It is. It really, so people are coming to us now wanting to do the premarital.
That's
awesome. We did family from Oklahoma.
Oh, that's right.
And they waive like waiting periods and things like that if you go through premarital counseling.
Wow, that's a great. And the state recognizes
right.
this.
It's a state.
And
state.
So we yes. So
in El Paso, it's got to be a 90% success rate, just with Hispanic families versus you know the rest of the state for some reason.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and the concerns we have is counseling. Like we do an online. We've worked with an online group, so we have an online premarital one. But, you know, we tried to get counseling programs involved, and counseling programs have said, well, there's no research to indicate that it's effective. But part of it is because they're not knowing what to identify.
Yeah, Prepare and Enrich has a lot of research to back it up.
That's I know, and that's the thing. We've tried to point them to that, but it's still, I know in the Northwest, it's still hard to get that in.
They just won't admit it.
Yeah, we need to. We need to admit that if you come down and have a conversation about who you are, where you've been, where you're going, it's going to help you in the future of your marriage. And again, for the red flags popping up, you know, there's behaviors that people revert to when stress hits us, and we want to know how to work through that.
Next slide, please.
Okay. Are there any other questions or any other comments? Okay. So what we were discussing was that we talk in the book about mutual submission. You know, there's a lot of talk about submission, and we get ministries or leaders who want to talk about, and mostly, you know, what the woman submitted. You know, I think Dancing with the Stars, Cameron's Canyon was on a few cycles ago, and we noticed that the question they had was, how are you showing submission to your husband by dancing, you know, in this competition? And we were saying, why don't they just say it's mutual submission? We submit to each other. We trust each other. And so we felt mutual submission is an important term. Ephesians 5:21, submit to each other out of respect and reverence for Christ. And so there's 3 points here. First of all, creating a safe and sacred space. A safe space is a sacred space, and it's something that we create, not just I create. Respect and being respect worthy. When I have couples, they'll say, well, you know, this person doesn't respect me. Well, are you respect worthy? That's an important question. They're just like trust and trustworthy. Well, they don't trust me. Well, are you trustworthy? You know, you showed up drunk the other night. Well, I just drink. But when you're intoxicated, you are unavailable emotionally to your wife and your family. So, or your husband and your family. So, are you trustworthy? That affects them. So these are 3 things we found important. And I think as we've worked with couples, you know, it's 2 people creating this space.
And I don't think people realize that they don't have that automatically in your marriage. And then you talk to people that are married 20, 30, 40 years, and you'll also find that they never created any type of a safe space that I know that I can talk about something or approach Ron about it or share with him, and it's going to be, you know, confidential. He's not going to tease me, make fun of me for it. And this is a really petty thing, but we were married, what, about, you know what I'm going to say, don't you? We weren't married too long. And I was praying. We were having prayer time. And he said, this is paraphrase, it's so cute when you pray, or something like that, like patting me on the head type thing. And I didn't pray with him for probably 10 years because I thought, but I also didn't tell him why it bothered me either. And we did talk about that one time, and now, but I thought that, and it was nothing huge, but it just made me feel really small, and I thought, okay, that doesn't sound right. So we learned from that, but it also took us 10 years. I'm too stubborn to, like, sit down and talk with him and create a safe space and say, we need to talk about this. So, but we have.
Well, the first year was, and this is how I was taught as a man. I mean, the first year was, well, you need to get over it, you know, type of thing. I said, I'm sorry, so get over it. But I had to learn that creating a safe space takes a lot of time, because creating a safe space means another person can be vulnerable. And I think that's one thing we see with couples. Are they willing to create a safe space where the person feels vulnerable and can say, I feel safe around you?
Yeah. Can you elaborate just a little bit more on exactly what you mean by safe and sacred space?
Okay. You want
to go ahead?
With Agape, we're a congregation where people can come off the street, and women in prostitution have come off the street. We had one solicit some people, so we said this is safe for both males and females. But what it means is that this is an environment where you can let down and be you, and nobody's going to judge you, nobody's going to make fun of you, nobody's going to take advantage of you. And so I believe when I read the prophets and where God says, I'm going to bring you back from captivity, and I'm going to shepherd you, and you're going to run and leap, you know, as opposed to the shepherds who've taken advantage of you, that for God, holiness and sacred spaces are safe spaces where we can come and relax and be who we are and not be taken advantage of.
So how do you create that within either marriages or families? Well, how would you recommend that you take steps towards that?
I would say, it's typically going to be, in most cases, the male needs to show, as we said earlier, I respect you, I'll take your advice, I'll listen to you, I will not belittle you, and I want this to be a place where we can enjoy. Like Harville and Helen Hendricks have talked about, the space where we can have a dialogue is a space for the Spirit. And so, for instance, if we're going to talk, instead of just walking up and saying, hey, we need to do this, what we've learned to say is, hey, is this a good time to talk? No, not right now.
When we first learned that skill, I thought it was the cheesiest skill ever. Because you're supposed to say, is this a good time to talk? And then that person can say, can you give me 20 minutes? Because, you know, we all process things differently. And but you know what? It works. I thought, I learned a new tool after 25 years of marriage that actually works. But I like it. And that's our safe. And it also gives us both time to really think about what we're going to talk about. And I know some of you, you've been married years, and you found out that what used to, you'd want to argue and talk about, you don't anymore. And I will tell, you know, younger couples that it does get better. Now, sometimes it's stuff we've swept under the rug, too, and we just don't talk about it, which is not healthy either. But I've found that over the years, we laughed one day, we thought, we haven't argued in ages. I mean, we might disagree, but we, and so it's funny how you start thinking back on that and learning that. I tell people, once you start getting having children, if you choose to have kids in your marriage, a safe and sacred space is hard to find, because it's got to be a quiet place where you can talk or be or let down. But we also that's where we teach our kids boundaries, and they know that, you know, this is our time right now. Or if we're talking in the bedroom or we're talking somewhere, it's our time. But we also listen to them, so they create those sacred boundaries and safe spaces with us. Like at Christmas, when can we just have, you know, we're very hospitable, but can we just have our time? You know, that's what we want, is our time. Or, you know, or is it time to... So I think it's something that you... When you say it, it sounds funny, but I know once we start asking people like around Agape, do you feel safe here? And they go, yeah, I do. I don't feel like I have 2 hours of nobody bothers me, you know. So.
And that means that we work hard to create a place where we can talk. So when we say, now's not a good time, but we'll talk in a few minutes, and we sit down, and when one person is talking, the other person needs to be listening. Because if I'm not listening, then she'll say, or if she's not listening, we're looking at her phone maybe. It's like, you're not listening to what I'm saying. So I don't feel like you're hearing me, and I don't feel like this is a safe place. But we actually listen. The exercise we do with people is to have them repeat back and forth. But it's an area where conversation happens, where we can be honest with each other. And, you know, when you say, it's cute when I pray, it makes me feel like a child, like I'm your child. And my response should not be, well, you need to get over it. My response should be, I'm sorry, I won't do that again. I know that made you feel bad, and I'll work really hard not to do that. So those are some ways to create. I don't know if that completely
helps.
Yeah. With kids, though, it's a little... kids are, you know, we go different places. You know, our middle son, he's scary smart, so his safe place is playing chess at Starbucks, you know. Whereas the younger one, it's watching airplanes land and just having conversation. But Lori has a safe space with them that's different than the one that I have,
yeah.
I think. And it encourages conversations. And so with safe and sacred spaces, you have respect, but also respect worthy. When we work with individuals, when they want respect, we say, are you respect worthy? You know, have you, you know, how do I know that? You know, I have to ask my, you know, and so if it's a couple, we'll say, you know, why, you know, he says you don't respect him. Has he been honorable, or has she been honorable? And it opens up a conversation. Trust and trustworthy also is another one. And this is Sells and Yarhouse have a great book on counseling couples, but this is a really good quote. We have found that the question of trust is a better gauge of relational intimacy than the question of love. And when people do, we love them, yes. But we have people all the time that say, yes, I love them, and they mistreat them. But the question is, do I trust them? And then the other one, do you trust them as well? And love will grow whenever there's trust. Needs to be
tried. Which, if you ever deal with anybody in an abusive relationship and you think, why didn't they leave? They love them and they don't want to walk away. They just can't trust them. And I think it's so funny, because I think this is so true. We gauge everything on love. And you can take that even to your kids. If your kids can't trust you and feel secure, and even as adult children, they can't trust you. And so a big gauge of when we wrote this book, my biggest thing was I didn't want to write a self-help book. It's not a how-to book on marriage. But I also thought, am I writing stuff that's not true? Is it just my perspective? And we had a chance to share the book at Agape in front of everybody, and our son and daughter-in-law were there. And it was funny, we went to lunch after, and we're like, be honest. And they both said, you know what, it was very spot on. And so, and I know that they've read the book, and they've not critiqued it, so I'm assuming that was good. But that was a good gauge for me, was to think that, is this only through my perspective, or have they seen, you know, did they see that too growing up, so.
I'm sorry, what is the book?
Oh, right here.
There you go.
Okay.
We have some flyers. The Marriage Table, it's a kind of a workbook, so.
So we were talking about some of the things that get in the way of you know, distract us from communication, but we think about things that are destructive to relationships. Like one, the big one is pornography. I think that's a big discussion. And we do presentations with community agencies, you know, police and so forth. And so when we talk about pornography being destructive, we can't take it from a faith-based perspective. And so we have males and females who say it's healthy, it's normal. But we're thankful for the many very, very staunch feminist groups that we work with who've pointed out that, that pornography is degrading to females. And one of the things we've been capitalizing on is just trust issue. So when we have people say, well, it's okay, it's not that bad, we say, well, how does your partner feel? And if they have a real honest conversation, we're finding that more and more partners are saying, I feel dirty when you look at it. And so if they can create a safe space to have a conversation, even at that level, pornography is destructive to a healthy relationship because they feel, it makes the other person feel unvalued. So that's where we can go with, you know, trust is a better reflection than just love. You know, yeah, I love her. I just, you know, I'm looking around. Or I love him. I'm just looking at other things. They know I love them, but how do? They trust you? And that's an important one. Proverbs 22, that should be 22:6. That was brought up. Train up a child, remember, in the way they should go. And when they are old, they're not departing. Interesting thing, we've done work with this, but I just thought we'd throw this out because I know this is a burning question. The thing that's always bothered me is that for so many years, parents have felt guilty if their kids walk away from the church. And I'm thankful that, that we've always taught parents that that's not the case. I mean, it's interesting. We don't blame God if people walk away from God, right? Nobody goes to God and says, what did you do wrong, God? We don't blame church leaders if somebody walks away from church. But we blame parents if their kids leave. And this has been a verse that's a culprit. But it's interesting. The word in Hebrew for train is actually dedicate, Hanukkah. The word for child in Proverbs is actually the word for a youth. It's an apprentice. Proverbs is about training apprentices, okay? And the way they should go is, the Hebrew is, according to their way. So this is it's actually better for youth. If you dedicate a young person in the direction they're to go, which is really speaking about a vocation, then when they're old, they'll not depart from it. We have found that actually if parents are guiding their children to moral development responsibility, they typically tend to follow that pattern, especially as we're dealing with a younger generation that's leaving churches, but they're leaving institutions, period, and they're not really going anywhere, and so it's becoming a big holding tank. So I think this verse should not be used to oppress parents and make parents feel guilty. I think it's the idea that we just guide them and train them and let them go, and they have a better chance of surviving. I think it suggests that we need to spend time with younger people and guiding them if we want them to grow. Rather than blaming parents, you know, your kids left the church, so you did something wrong. I think that's a bad application. It can't be consistent.
And a lot of times when you talk with the adult child, they'll say it's not my parents. It's some other influence, or their own thinking through things, or, you know, I think of all the information that comes at young adults now, all of us, how we rethink things, and sometimes we rethink things, and so I can't imagine now trying to find what I think is my way, you know, with everything. So, yeah, a lot of times the young adults will say, my parents did, they're great. So, yeah.
Yeah, our older son and his wife, you know, they're downtown Portland. They haven't been going to church. And And we sat down and had a conversation with them, and they were just like, no, it's not you. It's is our choice we made. You know, you've done what you're supposed to do. It's the little brothers that are harder on them. You know, we want to tell them, be nice to your older brother, because he's going to take care of you if we die.
Don't shame them.
But they're having to learn that as well. They're 14 and 12, and they're learning, you know, as you get older, we need to be respectful and encourage people and support it. So those are just some of the things that we thought we'd share from the wisdom literature. Again, creating safe and sacred spaces, respect and be respect worthy, trust and trustworthy. You can do this with leadership in congregations. How do you create safe spaces? Leadership, if they want to be respected, they have to be respect worthy, right? When we're dealing with young people too, who in the Churches of Christ who have talked about leaving. The one thing I don't see in the research is that there's a good percentage of young people coming from very dysfunctional Christian homes. Mm-hmm. And they've seen stuff in churches, you know, the abuse that we've worked with, pornography and so forth. And so that affects them. And I think that's a conversation we need to be having. If we want to be respected, we need to be respect-worthy. If we want trust to exist in the environment, we need to be trustworthy as individuals. So, all right, we have 5 minutes for Q&A.
Yeah.
Yes.
Talk a little bit more about that. You ask them, are you respect worthy? Because I feel like some people are going to push back on you and say, well, don't you respect me just because I'm, you know, made in God's image, or I'm God's child, or whatever. I'm your husband, or I'm your wife. They should respect me. I think there's going to be some pushback. Do you have ways of giving examples to say, this is what respect worthy means?
And you get that, because when you work with them.
So usually it's in counseling. If it's one person, I find if it's just, if I've created safe space, I can push them. Usually this is a question that I ask after they're telling me this thing they've run on, and I'm saying, and so I'll try to help. If they don't know that, you know, being drunk or being a married guy who goes to work and then goes on a work trip and sits in a hot tub with a bunch of single women, you know, flirting with them, you know, I don't understand how my wife can be upset about that. So what I try to do is guide them and ask questions, if that's making sense. But usually they're telling me what's going on, and they're saying, I don't get it. I didn't have an affair. Let's have a conversation about this. And I try to say, how do you think they would feel? How do you think they would feel?
How would you feel if your wife was in a hot tub?
That's a good one, too. Did you ask your wife how they felt? You know, and trying to get them... The best way is to have them say, tell me exactly how you feel. Does that make sense?
Now you couldn't ask that question if it was a domestic violence case, right. Somebody who was. Because that person isn't going to hear that. And, you know, you're dealing with other things in that issue. But if you're dealing with a couple that's, you know, most of the time they just need to work through that process. But no, if you're dealing with if you're working with the males in it, at which are usually the ones that have that, that's where the pushback comes from. No.
And I think
that's hard.
I think sometimes as leaders, that's where we call them out. You know, hitting your wife or calling your wife this or calling your husband this is degrading, and we try to get through that.
And it's almost like it's two separate things. Yes, your wife is supposed to seek to respect you and to treat you with respect. But the other side of that is you are supposed to seek to be respected worthy. What would that look like? And that's a way of loving your wife, is to be respect worthy.
Yes.
Perhaps.
Yes.
Yeah, and I go back to God. I mean, God loved us first. Jesus died for us. God is always initiated. So if we want to be loved and respected and trusted, we want to be the people to initiate that. I think that's a good way. Yeah. And that's good. That's good.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions? All right. There's some flyers here if you want to take one. It's not for sale unless it's $1 million. It could be for sale. But thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Have a good conference.